The Tom Woods Show, episode 2170.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. If you've ever wondered how younger kids can learn authentic American history, we finally have the answer. The Tuttle Twins children's book series now has an American history volume. Check it out at tomwoods.com/history. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Delighted to be joined by our old friend Dan McCarthy today. Dan is editor of Modern Age, which is a venerable journal dating back to the 1950s. And we're going to talk about some political stuff today, like what is the real fallout politically likely to be of the Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade, or of these January 6th hearings. There's a bunch of things to talk about, and I know Dan has particular insight into this stuff, so that's why we're talking to him. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. I'm delighted to join you.
I have a few questions I want to ask you because I trust your judgment, and I know you stay informed about stuff like this. So the first one has to do with a subject that may be, I wouldn't say stale, because it's still such a massive change to the political landscape in the U.S., and that, of course, is the overturning of Roe versus Wade. How do you think that will affect the elections in November? And that could be, I guess it doesn't even have to just be for Congress, but it could also be governors, stuff like that. What's going to be different about the outcome than if Roe versus Wade hadn't been overturned? Anything?
Yeah, I think the effect of the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade is actually going to be quite muted on this fall's elections, just because the economy is in such, you know, dire condition that the Republicans are going to have an enormous amount of momentum behind their backs. And so the question is going to become, do people, you know, care about Roe and really the regime of, you know, having legal abortion up to the moment of birth? Do they care about that so much that they're willing to continue to see their, you know, incomes evaporate, their savings evaporate as a result of inflation, as well as all the other madness and the disappointment of the Biden era and the Democratic control in Congress? And I think the answer to that is very clear, that in fact, Americans are far more concerned about pocketbook issues. And of course, you know, the idea that there is this overwhelming majority in support of the most absolutely radical and extreme abortion rights position is false. You know, most Americans might have, you know, a sort of vaguely fuzzy notion that Roe v. Wade is something they would support. But actually, when you spell it out to them and when you tell them, the effect of Roe and the effect of Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1989 is basically to create absolutely, you know, abortion up to the moment of birth, at least in potential. I think they're shocked by that. So there's, you know, a sense in which the politics of the abortion rights people is really, I think, a sort of figment of the baby boom generation. And it's interesting to look at these young leftists, and you might think that they would be super energized by the overthrow of Roe v. Wade, by this, you know, sort of tumbling down of a, you know, sort of foundational block of a certain, you know, kind of social progressivism. But in fact, you know, I think a lot of young leftists are far more energized about, you know, their racial politics and sexual identity politics and other, you know, sort of more recent issues than they are about something like abortion rights.
We're dealing with electoral questions. Of course, the issue comes down to, will your vote turn on it? I mean, you may feel a certain way about something, but will your vote actually turn on that subject? And here, I think it's been fairly consistently true for quite some time that the number of people who are single-issue abortion voters tends to slant more in favor of people who are single-issue anti-abortion voters than pro-abortion.
That's right. And of course, the geographic distributions matter as well. So you're going to find, you know, a lot of outraged people in perhaps California or New York, a lot of, you know, abortion rights supporters who want to go to the polls. But of course, in states that are already heavily Democratic, that's not going to make a big difference. Similarly, you know, you'll have a lot of pro-life states where you may get a boost to the pro-life turnout. But again, it's going to be, you know, not so much of a change from the drift that things would have taken, you know, even without this decision. So I don't want to say that it's not going to have any effect. I do think it, you know, the progressives, the left is trying to embarrass Republicans by saying, well, what are you going to do in cases of rape or incest? What are you going to do in the case of, you know, a 10 or 11-year-old girl who winds up being pregnant as a result of rape or incest? So the progressives are taking these, you know, very small number of hard cases and trying to make these the hinge upon which the whole issue is going to turn. And I think, you know, Republicans need to be careful not to get snagged by all this. Republicans also just have to be careful to avoid a kind of lazy triumphalism and the idea that, you know, sort of any kind of legislation they want to craft is going to, you know, sail right through state legislatures they control. They have to be a little bit careful. I mean, this is a fantastic victory, not just for conservatives and for Republicans, but, you know, Dobbs is a great victory for the unborn. It's a great victory for America. But conservatives should be very careful to take, you know, advantage of this victory, you know, in a systematic fashion, as opposed to getting very excited, trying to pass laws that might, you know, be unconstitutional and try to prohibit people from traveling across state lines or something like that. I think as long as conservatives and Republicans are able to avoid that temptation, they certainly won't be harmed by the results of Dobbs. And there's a very good chance, as you pointed out, that they'll actually be benefited.
Well, how about this? Am I wrong to think that most Republican governors, if they were being really honest, under the influence of a truth serum, would have told you that they were actually not altogether unhappy with the status quo under Roe because it didn't require anything of them, in the same way that politicians running for federal office could say, well, that's a state matter, so, you know, I have my opinion on it, but it really is a, or, you know, if it ever were to be overturned, it would be a state matter. And so, okay, well, the people in charge of state matters are governors. And you get the sense, I think, that some of these governors would rather not have to have this issue decided. Am I right about that? And if so, what's the best way for, let's say, Republican governors to proceed at this point? You know, from their own standpoint of staying in office, let's assume that that's a good thing for them.
Yeah, you know, I always think one is justified in having a certain degree of skepticism about politicians' convictions. But, you know, there is actually this kind of third alternative beyond the idea that politicians are just purely sort of rational calculators who are always deciding kind of what's most effective for themselves on the one extreme. And then on the other extreme, the idea that they are pure conviction politicians who are going to do the right thing, even if it winds up hurting them. Politicians, I think, you know, often have very ill-formed tendencies, and they are, you know, sort of fish that are swept along with the stream, as opposed to being either, you know, sort of calculators with pure interests of their own, or being principled figures with, you know, sort of rock solid commitments of their own. Instead, I think they are, you know, swept along by the tendencies of the party and of sort of the conditions around them. And it seems to me that, you know, this is a really interesting case where the convictions of grassroots Republicans and grassroots conservatives have in a way been filtered up. And I've been very surprised by this. But nevertheless, I think it's true. So the fact that conservatives in the base and Republicans in the base, especially those who are most engaged on this issue, tend to be quite firmly pro-life and anti-abortion, I think that means that, you know, most Republican governors actually do have, you know, perhaps a little bit of a push or a, you know, drift in the direction of trying to satisfy those voters and trying to satisfy that constituency. And yeah, I mean, that's partly rational calculation. I certainly don't think that, you know, most of these governors are creatures of, you know, sort of pure principle. But I also don't think that they, you know, calculate so carefully and consciously that they're playing sort of three-dimensional chess. Ironically, the people who I think are most likely to do that and who are cynical in that way are usually the kind of Republicans who get the presidential nomination. So I think that was true of George W. Bush, would have been true of Mitt Romney if he'd become president. That's why I think that, you know, Donald Trump actually deserves enormous amounts of credit for creating a Supreme Court that would overturn Roe. I don't think any other Republican of my lifetime would have done that. And that's based not only on the fact that all the other Republican presidents of my lifetime, in fact, did put abortion rights supporting justices on the court, but it's also based on the fact that I think these other Republicans, they're always political calculators at that highest level, at the presidential level, in a way that Donald Trump wasn't. Donald Trump simply said, you know, whatever his personal convictions may have been, he looked at the coalition that had put him in office, and he said, this is the thing that's most important to a segment of my supporters. And so I'm going to do the correct thing, you know, as a trade-off. I'm going to give them what they've asked of me. And, you know, and to heck with the consequences. I think Trump did that. And as a result, Roe fell and, you know, Dobbs was, you know, decided the way it was. You know, it's a historic, it's a shocking thing. I didn't expect to see it in my lifetime.
No, me either.
If it were ever going to happen at all. As far as what the governors can do right now, it's going to really depend, you know, state by state, you know, if Republicans control state legislatures or not. I think one thing that actually, it's both a good policy and also winds up being strategic, although for the most, you know, sort of tragic of reasons, Republican governors should really, you know, do as much as they can to support foundlings, orphans, adoption agencies. This is something where it's been shocking to see over the past couple of months here, a month or two, that Democrats and progressives are actually anti-adoption. I mean, it's not just that they're pro-abortion. It's not just they're, you know, pro-abortion rights. They've actually been, you know, putting out memes on Twitter mocking adoption and saying, you know, oh, look at these Republicans adopting children. Isn't this an awful thing? Isn't it terrible to be a child who's adopted? I mean, this is just, you know, I mean, this goes beyond parody, beyond the most, you know, sort of cynical and evil caricature I had imagined these people capable of. And I think, you know, not only is there a need to support adoption right now, but there's also, you know, tragically, this really significant political difference between a left that is anti-adoption, that's basically anti-child, and the right, which is saying, hey, it's good to be born and it's good to, you know, have a family, and adoption is an important institution.
I hadn't thought about that angle on it because I guess I hadn't realized the left's opinion on that. And again, I'm sure there are plenty of people on the left I could find who have a different opinion, but I hear what you're saying. You mentioned George W. Bush. I thought it was very interesting that we knew all about George W. Bush's opinion about January 6th, right? That we got plenty of communication from his office. Then Roe gets overturned and absolute silence. Now, at least publicly, he told everybody, you know, when he was in politics, that this was a bad decision and it should be overturned and he's pro-life and all that. Then it actually happens, and not, as far as I know, not a word, at least in the first couple of weeks, which is the only time anyone cares, not a word. I mean, so he couldn't even pretend to be happy about this. And I mean, I can't search the man's heart. I don't know what motivates him, but it doesn't seem entirely coincidental that he would be cheered for his opinions on January 6th and not cheered for his opinions on Roe if he favored its overturning.
Yeah, and you know, you've seen so many of the Never Trump Republicans fall into this, where, you know, people who for decades had claimed to be the, you know, pro-life and for overturning Roe, you know, the fact that the way it came about was thanks to Supreme Court appointments made by Donald Trump has created, you know, either a code of silence among these people, or they've actually flipped around and they've said, oh, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to overturn Roe. Maybe this was the wrong way to do it. You know, you've seen all kinds of excuses manufactured by your Never Trump sorts. And, you know, I mean, someone like Bill Kristol's on, you know, sort of one extreme, someone like David French, you know, is in a different position. But all of these people, they're either very muted in their, you know, sort of celebration of the overturning of Roe, or they're actually, you know, lamenting it. And George W. Bush, I mean, you know, I think you can give him sort of personally the benefit of the doubt about his convictions, while also recognizing two facts about him. First of all, that he is someone who is very much an establishment Republican, and so who, you know, I think looked at the Supreme Court always in terms of what would be good for the establishment Republican position and for the, you know, existing composition of the Republican Party, as opposed to actually trying to transform the Supreme Court and overturn Roe. So I think there was that tension within him. You know, I mean, Bush didn't want to put Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court, of course. He wanted to put his crony Harriet Myers on the Supreme Court. And nobody thinks that, you know, she would have been a vote for overturning Roe. And, you know, George W. Bush also, all of his women folk, his mother and his wife and his daughters, they're all big Planned Parenthood supporters. And of course, it's not necessarily the case that that is going to sway how a politician behaves. Sometimes they're quite willing to defy their women folk, but that doesn't seem to be the case with George W. Bush. I mean, he's a guy who wants to be, you know, seen as being a compassionate, nice guy. And, you know, it actually takes someone who's as uncompassionate as, you know, people might caricature Donald Trump as being, but someone who's actually as tough as Donald Trump was and as radical as Donald Trump was, if you actually want to change something as terrible as Roe v. Wade. And I think that's a lesson Republicans should take to heart right now.
Before we move on from this, I've been thinking that suppose you did have a Republican governor who is in a situation where he's got this big, big part of his base that wants action now that Roe has been overturned, but he also does want to appease mainstream opinion to some degree, and also a number of other voters who might consider him but would consider this to be an absolute deal breaker, that a way out of that, if we're thinking sheer politics, might be simply to put it on the ballot, make a ballot question out of it, and then say, whatever you people decide is what I'll do. And then if people decide X or people decide Y, he could say, well, my hands are tied. I said we'd put it up. And now, of course, a lot of people be upset about that. pro-abortion people will say, my rights are not up for a vote. And anti-abortion people will say, the rights of the unborn are not up for a vote. Yep, I know, it's not going to satisfy everybody. That's right. In America, everything's up for a vote. That's just the way the system works. And that might be one way to make it more politically palatable. What do you think about that?
Well, you're right that everything's up for a vote. And you know, when people make these principled arguments saying, you know, how could you possibly put a right up to a vote? Well, your right was already up to a vote on the Supreme Court, you know, among, you know, a vote of 9 people instead of a vote right. of a larger set of people. So the question is not whether it's being put up for a vote or not. The question is, what electorate is it going before? And frankly, you know, if you believe that America is a country that has self-government and that the people are ultimately in charge, they're the ones who have to make these top line, you know, sovereign decisions. In that sense, I think there's some merit to what you propose. Of course, different states, you know, have different referendum and proposition rules. Some states, you know, don't really have a very strong mechanism there at all, or any mechanism. And it does seem to me that the basic approach that Republican governors and state legislatures can take here is pretty clear. So, you know, in some states where you clearly do have overwhelmingly pro-life sentiment, you can have, you know, more or less total bans on abortion. In other states where you don't have that, you can nonetheless have restrictions up to week 12 or week 15. And these are restrictions that are actually parallel to the restrictions you see in Europe, Western Europe. So the idea that these restrictions are somehow, you know, this terrible infringement upon, you know, women's freedom or upon modern society, if that's not true in Germany, if it's not true in the UK, why on earth would it be true, you know, in Iowa or someplace like that? So I think Republicans, you know, they have control of the center ground here, you know, and I think they feel pretty confident about that. I think Republicans generally, you know, they are, you know, getting pressed on, you know, these extreme cases, like, you know, a minor who gets raped. But in general, Republicans understand, I think, that they have the center ground here and they should defend it. And I mean, you know, just let the left run away. Let them keep, you know, attacking adoption. Let them keep, you know, saying that, you know, we have tyranny in America if you don't have abortion up to the moment of birth, maybe even beyond the moment of birth. I mean, these people are really extreme. You know, let the extremists on that side continue to, you know, be as shrill and, you know, as demented as they are, and let the American public see what those people are like.
All right, before I go on, let me remind you about an app that's going to make your life way better, that's going to make you well-informed in a short period of time. Sounds kind of like the Tom Woods Show a little bit, doesn't it? But I'm talking about Blinkist, which takes all kinds of nonfiction categories of books and slims those books down for you to just 15 minutes of listening or reading. So you get all the key points, no fluff. I've told you about the old, old classics they have, like Machiavelli's The Prince and Seneca on Stoicism, but of course also a ton of modern books. For example, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. That is perfect for our audience. And then you'll even find on Blinkist Murray Rothbard's book, For a New Liberty. And that's one of the early libertarian books I read that helped put things together for me, that helped me realize that in one area after another, there was a freedom-based answer to what ails us. It's the kind of thing that changes your life when you read it. And that's the kind of title you'll find many of at Blinkist. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Let's shift gears a minute. Now, I mentioned January 6th briefly. So we've been talking about how, if at all, would the Dobbs decision affect November. How about the January 6th issue? Of course, what's been going on in Washington with regard to that has been televised quite a bit. I don't know how much viewership it's gotten, but I've heard some people say it's just a big show trial, and I've heard other people say, no, actually, Trump comes out looking pretty bad in this thing. Is this one of these issues where people already made their minds up a long time ago and it's just not going to make a difference? Or has this marginally hurt Trump? Or what do you think?
Well, what it's done is give people who already wanted to go after Trump a weapon to do so. And that includes not only, of course, progressives, Democrats, and, you know, overt Never Trump Republicans, but it also includes a lot of covert Never Trump Republicans. And we saw plenty of that during Trump's own administration, that his administration was absolutely riddled by people who opposed his agenda and opposed Donald Trump personally, and worked to undermine all of his initiatives. So right now, there are a lot of Republicans, establishment types, who do not have the courage to sort of do the Liz Cheney thing and to, come out as open enemies of Donald Trump and let the voters decide whether they belong in the Republican Party or not. There are a lot of, sort of worms in the woodwork who want to undermine Trump, but want to be careful about doing it. So they're the ones who I think are gaining something out of the January 6th hearings, because they're able to keep bringing this up and saying, oh, what about, don't you have some doubts about this? The chauffeur says that, anything that just creates a narrative and becomes a storyline they capitalize on. Of course, the actual substance of the January 6th hearings has been a nothing burger. I mean, Donald Trump didn't do anything criminal. There is nothing like a case being built against him. And just as the, two impeachment trials that Trump was subjected to were both sort of partisan fishing expeditions or spectacles, the same is true of January 6th. So it's not going to, do much to dent existing pro-Trump support among Republicans. It is, however, allowing some of the less open opponents of Donald Trump, it gives them cover to say, okay, yeah, I guess I'm kind of against Donald Trump, or it lets them say to people who are, sort of not quite at their position, but who are not strongly supportive of Trump either, to say to them, oh, come on, doesn't this give you some doubt? Doesn't this make you think that maybe Ron DeSantis would be a better nominee? I've been very interested to see, by the way, over the past couple of weeks here, and a couple of months perhaps, that Ron DeSantis really has become the choice of the Never Trumpers. And I mean, not the hardline Never Trumpers, but the people who, the dump Trumpers, let's put it that way. And, I've had a pretty favorable impression of DeSantis as governor of Florida. And even as a member of the House, DeSantis had a pretty good record. So I'm cautiously optimistic about DeSantis in the long run. But when I look at some of his friends, and when I look at the fact that these are, the sort of covert types who undermined the Trump administration, that gives me pause. And I don't like to see, DeSantis become kind of the hero of people who want to get rid of Trump, not because they think Trump is insufficiently, committed to fulfilling a right-wing agenda, but just for the opposite reason. They think that Trump, is much more right-wing than the establishment would like, and therefore they think that someone like DeSantis, even if DeSantis has been very conservative as governor, they think, well, he's more of a conventional politician, in terms of his attitude and activities, and we think that we can, sort of work with that more than we can work with Donald Trump. I want someone that the establishment can't work with. There was this piece in Axios, I think, recently that spelled out a second Trump term plan to dismantle, or at least really take on in a big way, the deep state. All the regulatory agencies, the sort of national security apparatus, to go in there with a really strong game plan of replacing the appointees, putting in good political appointees, putting the thumbscrews to the federal bureaucracy. This article was presented as something to panic over and, as the most terrifying, fascistic thing that Donald Trump could ever do. But of course, it's exactly the opposite. I mean, seeing a plan like that is really, that's very reassuring. That's the best possible thing Trump could do and is a pretty good case for him in 2024.
Let me throw out a name that's neither Trump nor DeSantis. And this would be entirely speculative unless you have some inside knowledge I'm not aware of. But do you think maybe beyond 2024, somebody like Tucker Carlson might have political ambitions?
There's a lot of support in the grassroots for Tucker Carlson to run. There's, there could very easily be a draft Tucker Carlson movement in much the same way there had been a draft Goldwater movement in 1960. Whether Tucker Carlson wants to do it, that I have more doubt about. And he's always said that he doesn't. And they really put you through a ringer if you run for president and certainly if you become president. And just think about this. I mean, this is one of the things that I think Republicans in general, but certainly, your more sort of firmly conservative or right-wing kind of Republican has to think about. Look at all of the, sort of legal tangles that progressives have tried to throw at just ordinary people who served in the Trump administration. I mean, they try to hit them with absolutely everything. Any minor, sort of mistake in record keeping or anything like that is going to become a huge headache. And also, you've got a very woke corporate America, including law firms, which are often not hiring Trump administration alumni. And look at the, of course, politics of personal destruction, as, the Clintons used to call it, which has been deployed against Donald Trump himself. And ask yourself, so if Tucker Carlson ran for president and if he won, would he, want to be destroyed personally the way that Donald Trump has been destroyed? you have to be willing to basically sacrifice, you know, all the rest of your life in order to make this one thing your focus. And I would not blame Tucker Carlson if he did not want to, you know, lose his privacy, lose, you know, the peace of his family, lose, you know, the ability just to be a normal person in order to become president. There's a very high price to pay, I guess I would say.
Well, that is an excellent point. That is an excellent point. I was thinking, because he had given a speech recently in Iowa, of all places. And Iowa, of course, is of great political significance. And it sounded like a political speech. But on the other hand, since I don't really follow him, maybe it's the same speech he gives everywhere. I don't know for sure, but I want to know what you thought about that. Now, given that when I got to know you, which would have been somewhere in the 20 years ago range, even only 20 years ago, even within just the time you and I have known each other, the political landscape has changed quite a bit. And the tone of political discourse has changed quite a bit. The issues we're facing have changed. If you were to go around saying, I favor family values, a strong national defense, and a free enterprise economy, you would sound like somebody from 1987. Things are different. So what I'm curious about is, if you had a group of young people who were kind of sympathetic to the way you look at the world, but who they just didn't have that much knowledge yet, being young people, what is the difference in the kinds of books you would have recommended they read, let's say 20 years ago, to understand the world versus what you would recommend today? Are any of them the same or are any of them different?
Well, you know, I don't know that there would be that much difference. And I think you and I were both way, way ahead of the curve, because we were, you know, certainly, you know, you were a Rothbardian, but you were very well aware of, you know, where Pat Buchanan was coming from. You understood, you know, what his arguments were. And likewise, I mean, 20 years ago, you know, I was very much a paleo conservative with, you know, a lot of paleo libertarian sympathies as well. And I think all of those issues are still the primary ones. And therefore, all the books I would have recommended 20 years ago, you know, including Buchanan and Rothbard and others, I think those apply just as well today. And in fact, in some ways, even better today. So think of someone like Sam Francis, for example. Now, you know, Francis was a guy with a lot of baggage, both in terms of his, you know, sort of racial views. He was a man who had some personal issues, difficulties as well. But he was a brilliant thinker, brilliant analyst of American politics and of, you know, American politics at the regime level. And right now, I encounter 20-year-old kids, and these are not, you know, sort of paleoconservative, archival, you know, sort of bookworms, but kids who are, you know, smart, young, you know, rapidly moving up in mainstream conservative institutions. Not just are they reading Sam Francis, but they're finding, you know, Francis essays that no one's looked at for 25 years. In fact, just the other day, a friend of mine was talking about how he's not a big fan of The Godfather. And I said, well, you really need to think, you know, twice, because the Godfather movies are actually quite good. Not only is that a conventional opinion, but in fact, here's a Sam Francis essay where Francis makes a very compelling case for The Godfather. And my friend was very interested in that. You know, figures that many of us had our eyes on, you know, 20 years ago and more are in fact, you know, sort of more influential now and more, you know, important now, even than they were, you know, at that time. It's kind of satisfying, but it's also just kind of exasperating that, you know, when you had these ideas 20 years ago, when you looked at the way that the post-Cold War American regime was going with its endless wars, even in the early 90s, right? I mean, we're not even talking about Afghanistan. We're talking about, you know, Gulf War I and all these other things. You look back, you know, 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago now, and you just, you know, you see that so many of the things that we advocated at the time that were considered on the fringe are today, you know, either in the mainstream or have a fighting chance of becoming, you know, the orthodoxy almost of the Republican Party. And if people had listened to someone like Pat Buchanan or someone like Murray Rothbard 30 years ago, just imagine all of the hardship and misery we could have avoided, all of the, you know, awful things that have happened in the last 30 years that didn't have to happen. So it's better late than never, and it's a vindication of, you know, things that we were saying 30 years ago and 20 years ago. But at the same time, you kind of wish that the message had gotten through sooner.
It's astonishing to contemplate, though, the difference. Yes, it's true that what you're saying is correct about the way a lot of Republicans look at the world. They're way more open to some of the things that we're saying, and even some of the quote-unquote more extreme things that we're saying. But in terms of mainstream opinion, it's amazing to think that not that long ago, it was possible for Sam Francis to be a syndicated columnist in the United States. Now, granted, he was probably the edgiest of the syndicated columnists, but he was one. He was in multiple newspapers. He did get into trouble, I think, ultimately with the Washington Times, but he was a syndicated columnist. So anyway, what would you, suppose you could get somebody to read a few titles. They don't have to be the best books in the history of the world, but the ones you think will pack the most punch and that they're going to have their head screwed on right if they really absorb what's in them. Where would you direct them?
You know, that's a tough question because...
It is. It's an unfair question too, because there's so many great ones.
A lot of my reading recently has been outside of the scope of contemporary politics. And instead, I'm either reading philosophy or I'm reading ancient history. And I increasingly think that these fundamentals are the most important thing. So even though this is not the direction that you wanted, perhaps my answer to go, and the thing that really worries me a lot, and I've seen this recently, you know, in person, is that even though a lot of young conservatives and young libertarians have pretty sound views or pretty sound instincts about politics and even about, you know, particular issues these days, and they may be, you know, discovering lost thinkers like Sam Francis, they don't have any foundational knowledge. They don't know anything about the American Revolution. They have, you know, only a very selective grasp about the Middle Ages. So first of all, I mean, a book like your own, How the, you know, Catholic Church Saved Western Civilization, that's well worth rediscovering. But so is, you know, just, I really would strongly encourage listeners to go back to primary sources and not to take, you know, one scholar's or another scholar's interpretation of things as the gospel truth, but actually go back, read Thomas Jefferson, read James Madison, read John Adams, and see what our founding fathers actually had to say about their own time and their own issues. And, you know, I mean, this stuff is written in English. If you're used to just reading Twitter all day, it might be a little challenging, but it's not written in, you know, it's not even as old-fashioned English as Shakespeare. I mean, it's very close to our own time. And with just a little bit of effort, you know, anyone today should be able to get the hang of understanding the 18th century way of thinking. Similarly, with classical sources. So, I mean, going back to a historian like Appian, for example, and looking at, you know, the little Penguin volume that has been put out on, you know, sort of Rome's civil wars and social wars, that's extremely valuable. And just, and then people should think as they read these books about the institutional conditions and the class conditions that led to the breakdown of the Roman Republic and the creation of the Roman Empire. Because these are the long-range problems I think are going to be confronting us, maybe not in our lifetimes, but, you know, not too far over the horizon. And Americans, I think, are very unprepared for any of this. They're not reading serious books and they're not reading primary sources. And so, you know, they have opinions about stuff that's happening day to day, but they really need to understand the general, you know, sort of foundations of nations and of political orders and of, you know, the sort of rise and fall of civilizations. And if you don't have that, then, you know, your day-to-day decisions might be okay, but you're going to wind up being outflanked by revolutionaries in the end.
Dan, take a minute to tell us about anything interesting going on these days at Modern Age, where you are the editor.
We have a fantastic essay in our forthcoming summer issue by Walter McDougall, the you know, sort of Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, who has written about Angelo Codevilla, who is a foreign policy thinker who died last year and was good friends with Walter McDougall. And Codevilla's final book, published posthumously, is on John Quincy Adams and the real tradition of American foreign policy. And this book about John Quincy Adams is terrific, but this Walter McDougall essay in Modern Age is actually even more than a review. It is a reminiscence upon, you know, friendship with Angelo Codevilla and also a sweeping but concise look at the trajectory of American foreign policy from the founding generation until today. So something like that, I think, is very valuable as a roadmap for people who want to understand, you know, especially foreign policy right now. Today, you know, we're seeing all of these developments with the Ukraine and Russia war. You know, just in the past day or two, there's been news breaking about how the Ukrainian government has put out a blacklist, basically, of scholars, journalists, and political figures that you're not supposed to listen to, who are supposedly compromised by being pro-Russian. And this list includes Rand Paul, Glenn Greenwald, John Mearsheimer, Edward Luttbach, who's a, you know, longtime political, you know, military strategist, you know, and theorist, Martin Van Creveld, one of the most esteemed military historians alive. I mean, this list is just astonishing. And the Ukrainian government has styled this as being a list of disinformation sources. And of course, you recently had an attempt by the Biden administration to create a ministry of disinformation right here in America. So there's a real attempt going on to, you know, sort of silence and quash any kind of really deep objective thinking about world affairs, for example. And I think this essay that kicks off the summer issue of Modern Age by Walter McDougall, it's going to be a nice sort of counterbalance to that, you know, narrowing of our horizons of thought about foreign policy. We really have to get back to understanding why it is that the founding fathers and the generation after them were so reluctant to get us involved in long-lasting crusades all around the world. And they really had the opportunity to do so, because basically what happened was, you know, after the defeat of Napoleon, you had a number of supposedly, well, in fact, really, reactionary governments take hold, you know, on continental Europe. And the tendency of a lot of liberals, you know, and some of these folks were even classical liberals, but the tendency of a lot of liberals in the early to mid-19th century was to say that there should be an alliance of, you know, rather more progressive nations like Britain and the United States that should try to resist the reactionary impulses, the monarchical impulses of various post-Napoleonic responsive regimes, right? Counter-revolutionary regimes. And this is what America was being asked to participate in when John Quincy Adams gave his famous 4th of July speech, basically saying that America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. So it's exactly parallel to the same kind of liberal international order crusading that you see America being pulled into today. So the Walter McDougall essay in Modern Age, you know, it covers at least, you know, some of the foundations of this, and will be very valuable to, I think, listeners of this podcast. We also have some great material in our reviews section, including Sam Goldman has reviewed Yoram Hazzoni's book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. And we also have some great arts coverage as well. We have an essay on the real origins of the blues and an essay on the film The Northman. So I encourage people to check it out. The website is modernagejournal.com. But the best thing to do, of course, is to subscribe to the print publication, which is quarterly, and we'll have the summer issue out soon.
Well, I want to say a word for getting the print publication, because some of us out here, I know there are some in the listening audience as well, are old school. We look at computer screens all day. It's a relief to sit there in your easy chair with something in your hand that you're reading, that you can mark up, not by highlighting it or something, but you can mark it up, you know, and you can have it on your shelf and you know where it is. And you don't have to say, oh, geez, what was the key word that I could type into a search engine? None of that, none of that. And not to mention you're supporting something very important. Modern Age has been around now for, what's it going on? How many years? Over 60, 65, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it started in 1957, so it's getting up there.
Yeah, it's getting up there. As am I, as it turns out. As I'm about to turn 50 in a few days, as a matter of fact. So I'm not quite as old as Modern Age, but I highly recommend it. And I myself have written for it. I've read it. I've really profited from it over the years. So I'll also link to modernagejournal.com and your Twitter, stuff like that, over at tomwoods.com/2170, which is our show notes page for today. Thanks so much, Dan, for sharing your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, everybody, coming up in the next couple of episodes, I've got straight from the UK, the great Dominic Frisby. We're going to find out what's going on over there. If you haven't heard Dominic Frisby as a guest before, you're just going to love this guy. He's absolutely excellent. You think, I don't live in the UK. It doesn't matter. He's great. He's brilliant. He's funny. He's everything you would want in a human being. And we're going to have a great time catching up on what's going on over there. Plus, he's got a great new project we should all be aware of. Then Tom Mullen, our old friend, is going to come on. We're going to talk about Jefferson and equality and what did he mean by all that. So make sure you keep on tuning in to the old Tom Woods Show, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.